This is a Triple J podcast.
How you doing? Welcome back to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl. We are well and truly underway for 2026. A few episodes already in your feed this year. So I want to remind you, if you have a question for the big man, you can send it in on Thursdays from 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time before we go live at 11 o'clock with Science with Dr. Carl. And get creative. Maybe you want to send in a question via the YouTube comments or leave an Apple review, which includes your question. Anything goes. Get in touch. We want to answer your question right here on this pod. This week, we got questions about lime cordial being a bacteria killer, steam having the capacity to burn, why that happens, why is it so hot that it can hurt, and does a plucked hair grow back? So much to get into. I'm Lucy Smith. Let's do this. The man joins me right now. Dr. Carl, how you feeling?
Ever so peachy keen. Now that I got over my stupid flu, I've started pumping iron again and I feel like $1 million.
Yes.
Hooray for being alive.
Are you feeling strong?
So, yes.
Okay, good.
I didn't get pneumonia, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, no. We've got you at full health, full capacity.
It's so good.
Yeah.
But I've spoken to many people of varying ages, and with the flu virus that's running around now, flu A, superclade K, which has nothing to do with me, there's people in their teens being knocked over and having pneumonia and taking 3 weeks to get to their full strength.
Mm-hmm.
Man, gee, I don't want to have that happen again.
Absolutely not.
Okay, to life, to our lovely audience.
To life, to the audience, to the questions. We've got Shayna in Frankston here. Shayna, I've never heard of this before. What's your question?
Hi, how you doing? So my question is, does lime cordial kill the bacteria in Greek water?
Yes and no. Why are you asking?
Oh, so we work in a field work NRM, and we were just talking about the water quality, and one of our mates at work said that he remembers hearing an episode with you talking about it. And I was like, oh, I'll call in and ask.
they're very different circumstances. So what you can do if you happen to be out on the road and you're working in the field and you need a drink, you can now buy those nice little things that look like a kind of a bicycle pump, and you stick them in the water and you pull really hard, and they've got this incredibly fine filter. Water molecules get through, bacteria don't.
Oh.
So that's one thing you can do. And you can boil it. With me, the specific reference is when we did our big trip on the Canning Stock Route. So we started off, so I spent a couple of decades test driving four-wheel drives in the Australian Outback, and it began with me doing the canning. And so we started off at Alice Springs, and then we went west for 1,000 kilometres, turned right and went north for 1,000 kilometres. In that 2,000-kilometre run, we saw only one other group of travellers in a whole month. We had to navigate our way from well to well, and sometimes the water was crystal clear, sometimes it was muddy, sometimes it had dead birds in it, sometimes it had headless lizards. Whatever it was, we drank it because there were three adults and two babies, and we were drinking 50 litres of water a day. It was getting up in the high 40s. And we didn't carry enough gas to boil 50 litres of water a day. Luckily, I had read that the Australian Army had done some research that showed that in certain cases, a totally synthetic cordial, none of this, it's got natural lime and natural lemons, no, just straight out of a vat, and none of this nice sugar, totally synthetic, you know, all the fake stuff, would kill some, but not all, bacteria.
Mm.
And so figuring that we had to do something, we used a combination of potassium permanganate crystals, which will kill some but not all bacteria, and the totally synthetic cordial, and we didn't get food poisoning and we didn't die.
Wow.
So in your case, if you got to drink water on the road, just get one of those little sucky things that'll clean the water with a massive filter.
That's amazing.
No, that's so cool. Yeah, no, that's very interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Shayna.
Thank you, Dr. Shayna.
I also love you fact-checking your workmate and going directly to the source.
He talked about the army as well, and he was like, I swear I heard Dr. Carl talking about it so many years ago.
Oh, it was an amazing run. So we had our little daughter Alice who was about, we got her vaccinated and that was it. We just went into the deserts for a month and vanished. And we were hitting high 40s. And when we came out at Halls Creek after a month, we went into the supermarket, which was at 30 degrees centigrade. Little Alice behaved as though we'd put her into a freezer and started getting, because she was used to 40 plus degrees.
Wow.
And she started getting goosebumps in 30 degree C air.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, okay. So that was a surprise.
That's insane. Thanks for your question, Shana. We've got Sean in Nipaluna, Hobart. Now, Sean, talk us through this kind of Star Trek phenomena, okay? What's going on?
Oh, hi, doctors. So this is based off the Star Trek transporter. So the whole idea of the transporter is that someone stands on the pad, it dematerializes you, so it turns you down into your molecules, and then it transports your information as a data stream to another location, and they basically rebuild you at that location. And I guess the debate that a couple of my mates have been having is, the person at the other end, are you the same person, or are you just a perfect clone of your former self and you've just died because you've been taken apart at the molecular level and then just sent as data across the ether, so to speak?
So you have been killed at one place and then reconstituted at another place, and that kind of raises the philosophical implications. Like, we know that you are made, Sean, you are made of chemicals. Wherever we look, we find chemicals. And yet we put those chemicals together and we do not know, firstly, how those chemicals turn themselves into a cell that will reproduce themselves. And you've got, you know, 35-something trillion, I think, no, billion cells that reproduce themselves in your body. No, I think it's trillion, 35 trillion. And then the next thing is consciousness. Where does consciousness arise from? Is it just simply because you've got these atoms together and they start working together, and this ties in with that whole AI? I think, by the way, we've got a whole series on Shirtloads of Science about, is AI conscious or not? So what's the question? Have you been killed? Yes. If the machine has a fault or blows a fuse, you don't get reconstituted at the other end. Is it a clone of you? Yes. Will it give consciousness and life? That's what they're saying, and I haven't found too much scientifically wrong with Star Trek. Is that, have I answered all your questions, Shane, or you got some more there, or have I gone weak on it?
No, that makes sense. So, yeah, you have died at one end and then you've been reconstituted at the other. And if it all works out, you potentially are the same person, but your consciousness might not have continued to that new person.
Well, that's the trouble. We don't know what consciousness is. The best, read an article in The New Scientist, type in New Scientist, Roger Penrose, consciousness, and he won a Nobel Prize. We had him on the show years ago. He's a brilliant man. And he reckons that it might be related to quantum effects in microtubules. Oh, my God. But I don't think we'll solve consciousness in a hurry. I don't think we'll get it right.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Dr.
Thanks, Sean. If you've got a hypothetical from a movie or a TV show, let us know. 0439757555. Jeff in Bundaberg, you've got a question about nicotine.
Yeah, hey, doctors. Yeah, I was just wondering why nicotine suppresses appetites in people. Like, I've just always wondered that.
There are three chemical effects. Unfortunately, the first one mentions that chemical that everybody's heard of, dopamine. And I hate mentioning it because there's about 1,000 other neurotransmitters, but let's mention it because in this case it's real. So nicotine stimulates the release of dopamine, which makes you feel good. And as a part of that, it reduces perceived hunger, because feeling good means, hey, I don't have any needs. I'm just feeling wonderful. The second one, it works on acetylcholine receptors, and they're in certain brain regions, which then go down the pathway of regulating your energy needs. And so once again, blah, 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 you don't feel hungry. And then the third one is a chemical called ghrelin, G-H-R-E-L-I-N. Look it up on Wikipedia. And it's basically to do with feeling satiety. So how does your brain know that your tummy is full when you've had a delicious meal? Ghrelin is one of the chemicals, and so it acts on that. And then, of course, on top of the biochemical pathways, there's a whole, you've been conditioned into it. Ah, I've had a meal, I'm full, now I'll have a cigarette, and I'm having a cigarette because I'm full, and a cigarette makes me feel full, and you get conditioned into it.
Oh.
All of those. I used to, when I was a smoker, I used to smoke a cigarette at the end of each meal and really enjoy it, and I was really surprised when a guy in a rock and roll band said, hey, you know smoking's bad for you? And I'd been trained in physics, I said, no. He said, didn't you read the report from the British Medical Society and the American Medical Society? No. And that was the first time I realised that smoking was bad for your health. I was such an idiot.
Wow. Well, you know, not an idiot. You couldn't have
Hey, lack of knowledge.
Yeah.
We all have different areas of ignorance.
Does that help, Jeff?
Absolutely. No, I've just got a couple of mates that, you know, I've always wondered how they can go without breakfast because by 9 o'clock I'm starved.
Ah. Well, there's two different philosophies. In Western countries that speak English, if you don't have breakfast, you are some sort of suicidal maniac that is starving yourself. But in the European countries, breakfast is drugs. So when we were walking across Spain, what would people would have for breakfast would be a cup of coffee and maybe a donut dipped into it, maybe not. That was breakfast. Yeah. It was amazing. So different cultures.
Now, Josh, what is your question about steam?
Morning, doctors. My question is passed on from my daughter who wants to know, what is it about steam that causes pain and injury when it's water vapour, whereas, say, water vapour from a cloud or fog or something doesn't cause us injury? So what is it about the temperature of the molecules that's causing us to have pain and injury when we get burned by steam, I suppose?
So true, Josh. When you accidentally get it out of the steamer or the iron or you've heated up some food and then you crack open the lid and then, poof, get a little burn. What's going on there, Dr. Carl?
A bunch of things. So firstly, with your daughter, I'm happy to do a free science Q&A with her school online on a Wednesday afternoon. So just go to drcarl.com and make a booking. And we do these free science Q&As all the time. So she can ask other questions. Second thing, water. Now, Josh, you know how – do you have a cast iron fry pan at home, Josh?
Yes.
Now, you know how when you heat it up and you've cooked off it, then the flame's off or the heat's off and yet it's still holding its heat? Like, you know, a few minutes down the line, you can't hold it with your bare hand? You can't hold the handle with your bare hand?
Yep.
That's due to a thing called specific heat, which is a measure of how much heat it can store. Wait for it. Water has 5 times the specific heat of cast iron.
Wow.
So water, like, it's so easy to burn yourself on soup. And it's storing 5 times as much heat per – so heat is measured in energy. It is in joules. So you're storing 5 times as much heat. So the thing that's bad about high-temperature water is that gram for gram – it stores a huge amount of heat. Flesh, mate, the water heaters in your house is normally set to a maximum of 55, I think, because I think 60 degrees C, just a flash of water across your skin, you've got a blister. So they're set to a maximum of 55. Now, just to clear up a misconception here, steam is an invisible gas. If you can see it, it's not steam. What you are instead seeing is molecules of water sticking together. And they stick together because of electricity. And the water molecule, H2O, part of it is negative, part of it's positive. And so they can stick together and the individual molecules can then form little droplets that float in the air. So if you have a kettle at home that you boil to make a cup of tea in the morning, and I hope you use leaf tea, just start it boiling and then look carefully at the as of making a whistling noise, as something comes out of the nozzle. And there's a zone of about maybe 6 millimetres where there's nothing. Mm-hmm. That's where the steam is. It's at 100 degrees C and it's invisible. And then, beginning about 5-10 millimetres out, you see the little water droplets. They've cooled down to 99. And so the thing that causes the damage is the heat. And unfortunately, water stores more heat than practically any other substance known to the human race, and yet we need it, and it's good to heat it up for soup. Does that help?
Amazing.
Now, do I leave something out, Josh?
So it's less the water vapour itself and more the energy of the steam.
Correct. The energy in there. And so, I've seen terrible things with steam. It's a terrible thing to deal with.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Josh.
Thanks, Josh. Narelle in Nui. Narelle, you've got a question.
Hi.
What's going on?
Yes, it's actually my 15-year-old daughter's question this morning when I was waking up.
Everyone asking questions on behalf of the kids. Get the kids on air.
Yeah. Oh, they're at school, Lucy.
God damn it.
Why do humans have eyebrows? And evolutionarily, when we've evolved, why have we kept eyebrows? What's their purpose and what do they do?
Twofold. Functional is to stop sweat from going in your eyes, because if you're exercising hard and you're chasing a deer or a kangaroo, a human can chase down a kangaroo, but it'll take you all day. The kangaroo can sprint away from you, but they can't sweat. We can sweat. And so, if you just keep running all day, you know, you might do 20 kilometres, at the end of the day, the kangaroo is just exhausted. It can't sweat. It's about to die of hypothermia. And then you can, well, you don't want to kill it unless you're really hungry. That's another story. So the first reason is to stop the sweat going into your eyes. And the second one is communication. And I remember seeing David Attenborough on TV many years ago, and they'd gone into a part of New Guinea where there was a tribe that had never made contact with Westerners. And so they went in there with a camera crew, and the tribes who were around that area said, don't go in there, don't go in there. So they paid the money, you know, shillings, the silver coins from the past, still used as currency. They paid them shillings to take them in there. And wherever they went in this valley, and the locals were really scared, there were none of these strange people. They went to sleep. When they woke up in the morning, there was this guy from that tribe that had never met Westerners with a sharp spear resting gently on his neck. So David Attenborough's lying there with a spear on his neck, and he says, hello, nothing. And he looks at the guy, and the guy looks at him, and then he thought, what's going on? And he raised one eyebrow quizzically, and then the other guy raised an eyebrow. And it turns out that's a second use of eyebrows, communication. So when you're trying to read a person what's going on with them, like, for example, you're playing poker, that can be a tell. In other words, an indicator of what they're really thinking. So eyebrows, the second use is massive communication from one person to another.
Fantastic.
Awesome. Thanks, Narelle.
Thank you, Dr. Lizzie. Thanks, Dr. Carl.
And this is Jessie in Geelong. Jessie, what's your question?
Hello, doctors. I'm here with my three-year-old, Dr. Henry.
And another question.
First-time listener of the show, and his question was, how high is the sky?
If you're talking about the sky as incorporating bits of the atmosphere, it goes out to the moon. Molecules from molecules of oxygen have been found on the moon, and those oxygen molecules came from the Earth. Secondly, definitions. There's two definitions. I've forgotten one of them. One of them is the Kármán line, and I think you spell it K-A-R or K-A-H-M-A-N, and there's another definition for the edge of space. And the definitions of space are either 80 kilometres up or 60 or 100 kilometres up. And so that's your second definition of how high the sky is. And I'm guessing the third one is when there's not enough oxygen and nitrogen to give you the blue sky, and the blueness, and we won't go into why the sky is blue. I'm guessing that begins to fade at around, look, I don't know. I'm guessing 20, 30 kilometres. I'll have to look up at what level of altitude are there so few molecules that the Rayleigh effect. The Rayleigh effect no longer makes the sky blue. And I'm guessing 20 to 30 kilometres, that's a guess.
So what is the Rayleigh effect?
The Rayleigh effect is why the sky is blue, which will take me 3 minutes to explain. You ready for it?
No.
Yeah. Yes, no, yeah?
Go for it. So, maybe try and condense it.
Imagine a tennis ball going down a set of stairs. It goes across, you kick it. It goes across, it goes down, it goes across, it goes down, and eventually it ends up on the bottom floor. That's what happens to a photon of light, I'm being loose here, when it goes from the sun and hits our atmosphere. So it travels from the surface of the sun to the atmosphere, and for 8.5 minutes it has literally not run into anything. It's managed to miss little tiny bits of stuff, and it runs into a molecule of oxygen or nitrogen. It is absorbed, and then it is, after a short delay, emitted with two provisos. The provisos are, firstly, it's emitted at right angles, and secondly, it's a little bit more blue. I cannot explain that to you except in the language called mathematics, and I can do it in 15 minutes as Rayleigh, R-A-Y-L-E-I-G-H, law of scattering, but trust me, that it comes out blue and at right angles. And so this molecule, like a tennis ball going down the stairs, goes stutter, 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 and keeps on heading down to the ground, and at each stage it comes out at right angles to its previous direction, a fraction of a second ago, and more blue, and you look into a bit of sky, and then suddenly this photon lands in your eye, and it's really blue. And that's one that's done like 1,000 steps or 1,000,000 steps coming down through the atmosphere, which is why the sky is blue. So here's a question for you, Dr. Jesse. You ready for it?
Ready.
Okay, so next time you go out with your child and on a clear day where there's no clouds, get them to look at the sky, and you'll notice, I'm giving you a secret answer here, around the sun and 180 degrees opposite, as a faded blue.
Mm.
But if you look at the sun and go 90 degrees left and right, it's a deep blue. So see if you can get your daughter, if she notices that, and then ask her why.
Dr. Anna, what's your question?
Hi, doctors. I was just wondering why we stick our tongues out when we concentrate really hard on something.
Mm. Do you do it? Do you know anybody else who does it? Do you know any kids who do it?
I definitely do it. I was sewing a quilt on the weekend and I was basically licking the tip of my nose. I was concentrating so hard. And like you see it on TV and stuff. So, yeah, it just seems like a really bizarre thing to do when you're concentrating.
So 2/3 of kids under the age of 5 will do it. And if you ask a large audience of adult humans, do you know anybody who sticks their tongue out when they're concentrating? 1/3 of people will raise their hands. So that's not 1/3 of people do it, but at least they know somebody who does. And here's a short answer, and I'll explain more. You are freeing up processor cycles in your brain. I'm treating your brain like a computer. So believe it or not, it takes a lot of processing to run your tongue. Your tongue is continually moving. You're dealing with 1.5 litres of saliva every day. And the number of times you bite your tongue is close to zero. So if you go looking online and you'll see Shane Warne, the cricketer person, there are many pictures of him poking his tongue out between his lips. And what he's doing, and also Michael Jordan, and we think that what they're doing is they're freeing up processor cycles so they can concentrate on their hard job. And because if normally the tongue is just sending a lot of information to the brain saying, don't bite me, don't bite me, don't bite me. Mm. And that's taking up energy. And so we find that there's a link between the brain, between your mouth and your hands. And so we've done the experiment where you get people to pick up something with their mouth and their hands will do spasmodic grabbing actions.
Mm.
And if you look carefully, if you get people to pick up things with their hands, their mouth will mirror what their hands are doing. And it turns out that the area for speech, which is part of your tongue, is right next to fine motor control.
Wow.
So the short answer is, we think, to free up processor cycles in your brain.
Hmm. Interesting.
Fascinating.
Thanks, Anna.
Thank you so much.
We've got Nicholas in Adelaide Hills. Nicholas, what's your question about fusion reactors?
Yes. Hi, doctors. I'm just calling in to ask about how does fusion reactors work, and how close are we to being able to develop and build one ourselves?
Ah, okay. So you're vaguely familiar with the periodic table? You've heard of it, the periodic table of the
vaguely,
elements?
Yes.
So it turns out that in the down near the middle bottom, you've got iron, and iron has the least, we'll call it energy, of any atom. Everything is going to end up at iron. But then if you start at the heavy end, like uranium, you've got these big unstable atoms, and when they split, they make two smaller atoms, and the splitting of a single atom of uranium will release enough energy to make a physical grain of sand, something you can see with your eye, jump a whole centimetre. And that's amazing when you think how small the atom is. And then we've got roughly 800 nuclear power plants on Earth, and 500 of them are working and 300 of them have been shut down. At the other end of the scale, we're going now to the very light atoms. If you get two light atoms like hydrogen, and you stick them together, you make a heavier atom called helium. But in this case, you get an absolute shirtload of energy coming out, more than from the uranium, and fewer radioactive waste products. So that's been the attraction of fusion, where you get two light atoms and shove them together. The trouble is, they have electrons on the outside. They resist being shoved together. So what you got to do is get temperatures of 15 million degrees. That's not the sort of thing you get by rubbing your hands. And then if they hit anything solid, they immediately cool down. So you've got to suspend them in a vacuum in a magnetic bubble. And the bottom line is that the physics is easy, but the technology is hard. Now, on one hand, I could come to your place and I could fuse two atoms of hydrogen to make a helium atom, but I would have to put in absolute shirtloads of energy. What you want is when you've got yourself a stable running system and the amount of energy you get is more than you put into it. We have not got there yet. There's a whole bunch of entrepreneurs around the USA and other places saying, we can do it in 6 months, give us lots of money. They're lying. Nothing personal. We've been trying to do it for half a century, and all the way through that, it's been fusion is 20 years away, and it's always been 20 years away for the last century. Maybe it's 15 or 10 years away. We might be heading to a breakthrough. We haven't got there yet.
Okay.
And the last thing, we absolutely need fusion engines if we want to become space travellers, because the highest speed we can get with a chemical rocket is 16 kilometres a second. But if we could get 3,000 kilometres a second, or 1% of the speed of light, we could get to Mars in an afternoon, not 9 months.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so we need fusion engines, and for energy on Earth as well, but renewables can do the job just fine.
Okay.
Thanks, Nick.
Any questions?
Thank you.
No? Great.
No, perfect. Thank you.
We've got Jack in Collie here. Now, Jack, talk us through what you've noticed.
Hi, doctors. When I am checking the fire trucks at work, I got to test all the lights on them as part of the vehicle checks. Across the yard, we've got those parking bollards that are wrapped up in the high-vis stickers. When I test the high beams, the reflection of the bollards on the bonnet is brighter than the actual bollards themselves. And I'm wondering why that is.
Okay, so you're in the fire truck. It's in the dark. You're inside the building and you're looking out. You switch on the headlights and there's this bollard that's got this high-vis reflective tape on it. Is that correct?
Well, not quite in the dark. It's outside.
Oh, it's outside. Are you? Yeah. Do you have sunlight landing on the bonnet?
Yes.
Oh, that makes it so much harder. Okay. So, firstly, the reflective tape used to be called Scotchlight tape. It's basically a corner cube reflector. So, let me explain that. Imagine you've got a cube, you know, which is exactly the same on all sides, the same area, and you take off one of the sides, and then you put mirrors on the remaining 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sides, and everything's at 90 degrees to everything else. It's really hard to do that. Now, if you shine a beam of light in at any angle, it'll come in and then go bounce, 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 and come back at exactly the angle it came in at.
Yeah.
And so we've got several of them on the moon that the astronauts put there, and many times a day, we run a laser beam, we humans, run a laser beam through a telescope backwards. It bounces off the surface of the moon, comes back to us, and so we've been able to measure that the moon is moving away from us at 4 metres a century. Getting back to your particular case, so we've got those corner cube reflectors on this bollard across the way, and we've got the headlight. What's the distance in height between the bonnet of the truck and your eyeballs when you're sitting in the seat?
Oh, it would probably be about half a metre or less.
And what's the distance between the headlights and the bonnet of the truck where you see the reflection?
Oh, that probably sat down less than 30 centimetres below the bonnet.
Okay, so I've got three answers, none of which I like. First one is that the you get the maximum brightness when you're looking straight down the beam. So when they send stuff to the moon, they send turn the laser on and then they switch it off. It takes 1.5 seconds to get there, 1.5 seconds back, and they pick it up. It's exactly in line, corner cube reflector. So the closer you are to the emitter of light, the brighter the light is. That's number one. I don't particularly like that. Number two, the red bonnet is slightly darker. I'm guessing here. Is it a red bonnet for the fire truck?
Yeah.
Okay. So the red bonnet might be brighter than the background of the bollard. So you're seeing the brightness of the light against a darker background, maybe. And the third one, can you do this experiment for me? Did you have polarizing sunglasses? Do you know what I mean by polarizing sunglasses?
Yeah. I think I got a pair in the car.
Yeah. So with polarizing sunglasses, if you aim them at some of the displays on a car, and as you tilt them around through 90 degrees, suddenly the display goes dark or bright. Okay. Then you got polarizing sunglasses. Can you do that experiment again with the polarizing sunglasses and let us know what you find?
Yeah.
Okay. And make sure you write it down and give us your name and send photographs and send it an email, and you might get a Triple J fun pack. What's the email address?
We'll organise
Triple J at triplej.com.
I don't want to be. But Jack, thank you so much for your question.
Thank you, Jack. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Wow. Very in-depth there. Yeah,
it was complicated, wasn't it? There's a lot of stuff going on all at the same time.
Jennifer from Toowoomba. Jennifer, what's your question?
Hey, doctors. I was wondering if plucked hair grows back because there seems to be two answers.
What are you finding in your personal experience?
Well, being a menopausal woman, we get the random hairs growing out of the chin, etc., and you pluck them out and they grow back.
I've been able to convince my two-year-old nieces that the hair has migrated from my relatively bald scalp through previously undiscovered anatomical channels to come out through my ears and nose, and they believe me.
Oh.
Right, okay, moving right along. So hair goes through three cycles. It grows, fancy name, anagen, A-N-A-G-N. It then thinks, I've had enough growing, I'm just going to pull back a little bit, and that's called catagen, and then it goes into a long resting phase called telogen. So when you pull the hair follicle out, you're pulling out you're pulling out a shaft of keratin, which has the same atoms in it as the keratin in your fingernails, but they're organized differently.
Yep.
And then you pull it out cleanly and another hair will come out. However, if you do it often enough, you will eventually maybe damage the hair follicle, and then that follicle will no longer produce hair. But along the way, you've created a lot of pain. Now, my daughter Lola is in charge of my eyebrows, and I've managed to convince her not to pluck them out because I cry a lot.
I know. It's hard.
Don't you cry?
Yeah.
Does it matter, like, you know, if the hair's like a dark colour, or if it's, you know, when you get older and you get grey?
Yeah.
Does it matter on the stage of the hair, the age of the hair, whatever you have, you want to phrase it?
Oh, when you pull it out? Oh. Yeah. I had not thought of that, but that is incredibly deep. I am guessing that if you pull the hair out during the growing phase, you might have a slightly higher chance of causing damage. I do not know. If we have a dermatologist, please ring in the next 5 minutes to 0439 757 555. Dermatologists, they own hair. So it will eventually kill or damage the hair follicle, but you might have to pull it out 100 million times or something, you know, like a bunch.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jennifer.
Nathan in Endeavour Hills, you got a question about synesthesia. What's up?
Yes, good morning, Dr. Smith and Dr. Krushelnitsky.
Dr. Krushelnitsky, that is a good pronunciation. From where are you?
I am from and born in Australia, but both my parents are from Poland.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic accent. Very good accent.
Yeah.
Okay, continue along. Wow, thank you.
So last year I met someone who had a cognitive colour association. I can't remember if it was chromesthesia or synesthesia. And after a quick squeeze of things related to that sort of realm, I found I related to aphantasia more, which is like having a blind imagination. So my question is sort of twofold. Is there anything in the noggin going on that's measurable or traceable for these sorts of things? And for the scientific process, how are these sort of things researched and recorded, since it's all a bit abstract?
Okay, I'll answer the second one first. So Charles Darwin was very clever, and he had a cousin or something called Galton or Gorwin, who went to a fair in somewhere in England, and he noticed that they were trying to guess the weight of a pig or a cow or something, and he thought, let me just have a look at all the numbers. And to his surprise, the average of all of the sample of the numbers that the people had written down was really close to the actual weight of the cow or the pig. And so you've got that phrase that came from him, the wisdom of the crowd. And then later, he was at Oxford University, and I don't know the exact question he asked, so I'll just sort of make one up that is obviously not appropriate to Oxford. Hey, when you were last on holidays at the beach, okay, we're not doing that in England because all their beaches are made of stupid rocks, and you're lying on the sand and you're looking at the ocean, can you imagine that? And I can really easily just imagine I'm lying on the sand on my back and I can see my toes and this blue ocean. And to his surprise, a lot of his fellow academics could not imagine that.
Wow.
And they literally could not. And so he called it A for the root not, you know, A means not, fantasia, being able to make an image. And so one way to measure it is simply to say, can you imagine yourself lying on a beach seeing the ocean? And then there's a synesthesia thing. And I've mentioned before that even today, some musicians say that when they're creating music, they're looking and they're seeing these bubble, these coloured bubbles, and they're just moving their fingers around on the keyboard or on the strings, and they keep on moving it around until the coloured bubbles look pretty or something. And so, sure, they're hearing the sound, but they're... So we're talking about crossed senses. We all have crossed senses to some degree, and the easiest way to know it is that if you're just about to fall asleep at night, and then in my case, if somebody slams a car door off in the distance, I'll feel this ripple in my flesh run from my head to my toes. So we all have it to some degree, but people with full-on synesthesia, all of their senses are intermingled, and so if you give them, say, garlic to smell, they'll see colours or something like that. So there's a whole bunch of questions. Now, the first part, has anybody done some studies to then go looking in the brain? And I don't know. The ways to look in the brain would be either MRI scans, which are messy and expensive, or EEGs. And I just do not know if people have done that. My knowledge is deficient in that area.
Fair enough.
Thanks, Nathan. We've got Dr. Brooke Nathan in Hobart. Dr. Brooke, what's your question?
Dr. Brooke, welcome.
Hey, doctors. So this might be a simple one, but the other day I was swimming in the ocean and I was kind of just floating there, and I found that I just kept floating through warm parts, just warm patches of water, but they didn't last very long. And I was just wondering why there are just warm patches in the ocean.
Are you in Hobart?
Yes.
Mate, there's no warm water anywhere. You're crazy. It's all freezing cold.
Well, very true. We did have a nice warm day, though, on Tuesday.
Okay, so what happens is that you do not have perfect mixing, and so if the water just happens to be in the same spot over shallow sand, maybe only a metre deep, it will be a little bit warmer. On the big scale, look up Ekman spiral, E-C-K-M-A-N, where you can have big spirals 3 kilometres deep and, you know, kilometres long that bring water, cold water from the depths to the surface, and then sometimes you get cold patches in the ocean, in the beach, that are just much colder than everything else. So it's a combination of cold water from an Ekman spiral, warm water from just sitting in the sun not being mixed.
Right. Yeah, okay.
And do you wear a wetsuit?
No, I didn't.
Oh, my God, you're so tough. I went for a swim yesterday and I wore a wetty.
It's still summer, Dr. Carl.
The trouble is you've got these three depth indicators on your body, your genitals, your belly button and your nipples, to indicate how deep it is. I was just sick of it.
Yeah.
So I thought I'll just put on my little shorty wetsuit and go in and I bypass that.
Nice. Brooke, thanks for your question.
And you're so brave swimming.
Worries,
and it's good for you. And there's a lot of evidence showing that swimming in cold water is good for your physical brain and your physical health, your mental brain and your physical health.
You never regret a swim.
Yep, after that, you never regret it.
Dr. Carl, I'll catch you next week. And that's it. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. This episode was produced by Matteo Bascarin and Josh Brennan. I'm Lucy Smith. We'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.